This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In today's episode, Ryan and Andrew experience Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk in 70mm IMAX and try to decipher what exactly Luc Besson intended with Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets.
I doubt we'll get to the bottom of that in this podcast, but we're going to start with Dunkirk, a film that's certainly more experiential than anything for my money, and obviously seeing it in the 70mm IMAX certainly helps the case. Before we get into that, I just want to point out that most of the 70mm IMAX screenings, unfortunately, are cropped. Apparently, there are only like 31 theaters that displayed at the proper aspect ratio. We're just fortunate enough to have one that is right near where we live, so we checked it out in the Providence Place IMAX. So pretty much everyone knows the story about the evacuation of Dunkirk Beach with the Allied forces, being taken out while the Nazis really press on. It's really intense seeing this film take up the whole screen. I know that it's funny that this is a PG-13 rated war film because it's actually one of the more intense war films I've ever experienced. And a lot of it is just the, can be attributed to Hoyt Van Hoyt Tema, I think, and, you know, really utilizing that at IMAX frame really, really well in centralizing you, you know, either in the cockpit with Tom Hardy or, you know, God forbid, on the beach itself or on the boat with Mark Rylance. It's really just it just drags you in. And obviously I can nitpick here and there, but I think that actually kind of defeats the greater purpose of even what Christopher Nolan was going for, and that this is just extremely, extremely intense. And it might run out of gas here and there in spots for me, but what the hell, give a shit.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think Dunkirk is less of a film and more of a visceral experience. Like it feels like something, like if you didn't know Christopher Nolan directed this or whatever, like this would be War, the IMAX experience, you know, one of those films that they put out. And that isn't me criticizing the film at all. In fact, I think the only way to see this film is in 70mm IMAX because, I mean, I feel like, I mean, and I haven't seen it in a regular theater, so I may be completely wrong in this. I'm sure there are plenty of people who really love this film in a regular format. But for me personally, I just feel like the 70mm IMAX really added to the experience, particularly, I mentioned after screening, you know, I mean, I really love the aerial stuff, you know, with Tom Hardy as this fighter pilot. And I just love the shots of, like, looking through the crosshairs from the pilot's screen. Like, it feels just like an immersive experience, you know, just experiencing all the horrors war has to offer. And there's plenty of shots throughout this film that really make you feel that. I remember distinctly a few shots of, you know, one of the boats is capsizing, and there's the shots of, like, the water that's slanted and overtaking the camera. I thought that stuff was really great and powerful stuff. And, like, I mean, I just feel like this is such an immersive experience that, I mean, it's hard to even talk about in terms of, as I mentioned, in terms of things like film. And for me personally, I actually, this one feels to me, and some people may disagree with this, but to me it feels like almost like an early Hollywood war film. Like, if you put this film in black and white and you remove Christopher Nolan's name from it, I find it hard to believe, and, you know, ignore the recognizable actors, you know, I find it hard to believe that people would be able to surmise that this is a modern day film rather than a classic war film. And I have a feeling that that's what Nolan was going for. And it feels like there's been sort of two major reactions to this film. A lot of people are saying, oh my God, this is a stone cold masterpiece. This is amazing. Nolan's best film by far. There's a lot of people in that camp. And then there's also a lot of people who, I mean, let's face it, Nolan has his fair share of detractors, in the film criticism world. And a lot of people are sort of harping on the typical, Nolan criticism. But for me personally, I feel like it's hard to harp on those things because this film was created as this seemingly, throwback, visceral experience, and I think it definitely succeeds at that.
Absolutely, and I think it's it just kind of would do a disservice to really nitpick anything here and there, like I was saying earlier. And I think what was most impressive to the film for the film about me, one little nitpick about the IMAX experience, I do agree that it is most certainly worth seeing in this format, and this has more to do with the IMAX theater itself. I think the sound is really bad in those theaters. It's just like overly boomy and muddy, and there's certainly, you know, more like the sound effects of the gunshots, for instance, actually had a lot more weight than the explosions because they sounded a little bit more natural. There's a scene where you know, Harry Styles and company are kind of trapped underwater. And one thing I know, I walked out of the theater saying that, you know, the Harry Styles thing kind of stuck out to me. I was going to bring that up and criticize it up until we saw Valerian yesterday, but we're going to get to that in a little bit. But anyway, so the IMAX experience is worthwhile, just with the caveat that the sound is actually going to be a little bit weaker in terms of the overall fidelity of the audio.
See, it's interesting you mention that because, I mean, I'm just bringing this up just based on how people were reacting in the theater, people who mostly don't know about these things. And I thought the sound worked really well for me personally, in particular the gunshots. And the guy sitting next to me, in fact, was like jumping out of his seat when like gunshots went by. And I was thinking to myself, you know, you're just sitting here watching a movie, right? But I mean, I guess it's a testament to the work done on this film that people had that experience. And I think if you see it in the right, in a right IMAX screen, I think you'll definitely get that experience for sure.
Absolutely. And getting back to my original point that I was going to get to before I got off on the tangent, was that this is just an absolute masterpiece of editing, and also from Hans Zimmer's score. It really just ratchets up the tension. I mean, there are three different points of this story that are being told, you know, obviously from the Air Force, Navy, and Army, but they all start at different points within this timeline of this event. So, you know, with the Tom Hardy one and as the Air Force, it's 1 hour before the evacuation. On the evacuation on the beach itself, it's 1 day before. And with Mark Rylance as one of the civilians who is offering his yacht to go rescue soldiers, it's 1 week before. But it never feels disjointed at all. I think it's just, and you know, obviously in the score, there's like this ticking clock motif that's kind of going on in the background that is just really gives this palpable tension to it. And obviously, even if there was no score whatsoever, I still think the film would be as suspenseful. But it really just like kind of adds that different dimension to it, and really kind of gives you like an even almost like sinking feeling in the stomach. And I think that's actually one instance in which IMAX's overly boomy bass actually was an advantage.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. And I mean, you know, I feel like I'm in the camp of this is a very good film, but I don't think I'm in the camp that calls it a Stone Cold masterpiece. That may possibly change after seeing it again or whatever. But I feel like it's a very good film, and I do want to point out some of the criticisms I have of the film, just because, you know, what else are we here for? But I mean, I thought some of the stuff with Mark Rylance in the boat and stuff like that, I thought some of that stuff dragged a little bit, and also because I didn't feel like I knew what the real overall story was there connecting to the overall war film. And I understand what Nolan was going through with that shot later on in the film. It's not really a spoiler, but of all the boats, you know, like of the people just not that aren't in the military, just helping out the soldiers, you know, with their boats. And I thought that was a powerful moment, yet I did feel like that moment wasn't completely earned, though, for me personally. And I think a lot of the criticism of this film, and, you know, I'll get to classic Nolan criticisms, is a lot of people are criticizing this film because, you know, there isn't really any characters in sight or whatever. But that's why I brought up the fact that this feels like a throwback to like a classic, you know, early Hollywood war film, because it's just all about the experience of war and the horrors it has on these people. And I feel like if Nolan took the time to establish some of these characters, you know, he might have lost some of the experience that he was trying to capture. But I do feel like there should have been a bit more with the Mark Rylance thing, because he spent so much time with him and his son and the kid who works with them or whatever. I just felt like there should have been a bit more of that if he was going to try and invest us in that story and try and use it as an emotional moment at the end of the film. And that's really one of my major criticism of the film, is that, you know, if he was going for that, you know, purely visceral war experience or whatever, I don't think he would have spent as much time with the Mark Rylance character without even giving us anything to it. So I would say that would be my overall one like staunch criticism of the film, is that I felt like there needed to be, if we were going to spend so much time with those characters, I felt like there needed to be a bit more. And maybe that's just me talking, because Mark Rylance stole an Oscar from Sylvester Stallone recently. That for me personally, I don't think he deserved, but he's a great actor without even saying that. But I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I will say this had more heart than a lot of Nolan's recent films. Interstellar left me kind of cold, as the Dark Knight Rises, and I know you're shaking your head right now. That just Interstellar just didn't connect with me. This hit a little bit more close to home. Obviously, I'm a history buff, so obviously I'm, you know, part of the built-in fan base. But I just think that for instance, there's this one shot early in the film, one sequence early in the film, where there's a British soldier and a French soldier who are carrying a wounded soldier to one of the evacuation ships, and it's like this really, really tense scene. And you know, Hoitema keeps the camera really close, and it's just really incredible watching how much tension is derived just from watching these two try to beat the clock and get this soldier on the ship. But it's done in such a humane way, and there's, you know, one moment where I won't spoil it, but you know, it elicits like an inner cheer from you, I guess I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know what else to say about this film other than, you know, as I've talked about, it really is this really visceral experience that you just really have to see it in this format to really get the complete picture of. And I was going to talk about something, but I'm blanking. I just lost my train of thought. So I don't know if you have anything to say while I try and re-catch my thought.
Not particularly. I think we pretty much covered this film. I do kind of want to revisit it either on Blu-ray or... I probably won't go see it again in a theater, but I just want to kind of see how the sound mix stands up in a more traditional setting.
Well, you mentioned Interstellar as Nolan's previous film, and I just wanted to bring up sort of Nolan's filmography, because I feel like that's important to talk about anytime a filmmaker of his caliber puts out a new film. And you mentioned Interstellar, and I will say, the first time I watched Interstellar, I saw it in IMAX, and I didn't particularly care for it. And I don't know how many times you saw the film, but I'll be honest, when I watched it a second time, like, the film actually blew me away. And I feel like sometimes that's the case with a lot of filmmakers, where you may see a film and it's just like so much going on. There's different things going at it. And like when I first watched Interstellar, it didn't really come together for me and work for me. But I will say on a second time, it did. I feel like Dunkirk, I feel like it might be an opposite type of thing, where I feel like the first time you experience it, it's this crazy visceral experience, but I'm not sure how well it holds up on rewatch. But for me personally, I feel like this is a very good Nolan film. It's not at the top, it's not at the bottom or whatever. I think it's somewhere in the middle of the pack. I don't know what your thoughts on that are.
Pretty much. For me, The Prestige will still be tops, and I can't imagine that ever changing, just because of my admiration for that film. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting how Nolan has kind of, I don't know if it was, you know, because of the Batman films, it probably was, and I think that's what kind of propelled him to this transcendental status as a filmmaker, where he's in that, you know, untouchable early 90s Spielbergian way in which everything he does, and whether or not it's critically acclaimed, it's guaranteed, like, oh, Nolan's involved in this project. This is, you know, cause for 2 years of speculative debate. And it's really interesting to see, because I've been kind of on board since Memento came out. I watched it on DVD for the first time, like immediately after it was out of theaters. And since then, I've just been completely hooked. And there's nothing that, with the exception of The Dark Knight Rises, there's really nothing he's done that I've outright disliked. So I think Dunkirk is really, it shows where his passions lie. And I think this film has really noble intentions. And for that, it's easier for me to forgive some of its shortcomings, whatever they may be.
I also just want to give a brief shout out to Tom Hardy's eye acting.
Yes.
Because I've heard a few different critics allude to this or whatever, and that, you know, it's another Nolan film where, you know, in The Dark Knight Rises, he was pretty much covered in a mask playing Bane or whatever. And in this film, he pretty much is as a fighter pilot or whatever. But you could still feel his presence through it, and that's just a testament to his actor. So I just wanted to briefly mention that. But Dunkirk, definitely a very good film, and I definitely recommend seeing it in 70mm IMAX. And with that being, with our thoughts on Dunkirk pretty clear, we're going to transition to some news stories of the week. And the first one I'm going to touch on is the recent news that Daniel Craig is officially returning for a fifth Bond film. And I am overjoyed at this news. I'm a big fan of Daniel Craig. In fact, he's my favorite Bond, and really that just stems from his performance in Casino Royale, which for me personally, I think is the best performance by, you know, it's an actual acting performance in a Bond film. And don't get me wrong, I'm a big fan of Bond franchise in general, but that was the first film where I really felt, you know, a true emotional connection to the character, and it felt like the character was layered. And with that in mind, I feel like Daniel Craig has taken the character in a direction which I definitely appreciate. I also didn't want his run as James Bond to finish with Spectre, which I honestly thought was pretty bad. You know, and it feels like, you know, it's pretty common for most Bond actors to just go off and on with good and bad films. And pretty much Daniel Craig has served that with, you know, he started with Casino Royale, fell off with Quantum of Solace, came back with Skyfall, and then fell off again with Spectre. So I'm just glad he's coming back for a fifth film. Nothing is known about the director or writers just yet, but I'm just glad that he has a chance at finishing on a strong note, because I honestly don't see him signing on for another film after this.
I agree. He's getting up there in age, so I think it's the toll that takes on your body of doing this. He's been doing it for well over a decade now. I'm totally fine with that. I do agree that Daniel Craig, this has been, you know, the best stretch of Bond acting. And, you know, obviously I loved, you know, the goofy Roger Moore stuff and everything, and even the early Sean Connery. And Pierce Brosnan was the Bond I grew up on and kind of weaned myself on and wanted to be when I was 11 years old. But, yeah, Daniel Craig really just took it in a different direction, and I really admire what they've done. despite the missteps of Quantum of Solace and Spectre. I think Casino Royale and Skyfall are amazing. So with that, I feel like the odd-numbered films in this particular entry in Bond are probably going to be a lot more, are clearly a lot more solid. So hopefully, like you said, this sends him out on a high note, and hopefully Idris Elba is not too old to play the character once he's gone.
Amen. We also wanted to briefly touch on, obviously, there's a lot of news spilling out of Comic-Con, which has been taking San Diego by storm in recent weeks. And we just wanted to touch briefly on our thoughts on a few of the trailers. And I guess we'll start off with the trailer for Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One. And Ryan, I know you've got some hot takes for us, so let's go.
I just don't understand why, in, you know, a show like Family Guy rightfully gets crucified for having all these, you know, banal pop culture references that, you know, just serve absolutely no purpose whatsoever and detract from everything. And then when Steven Spielberg does it, all of a sudden it's the fucking second coming of filmmaking. You know, I appreciate the fact that he's using the same technology that he did with Tintin. I think Tintin is actually one of his stronger films of the past, I'll even say the past 30 years, to be honest. But in this, it just feels completely hollow. It's all just, you know, goofy pop culture references. And it's clear, very clear, you know, obviously with the advent of Stranger Things, that 80s nostalgia is really at its pinnacle right now. And then maybe in another 10 years, we're going to be the assholes creating this stuff. And people are going to be complaining about 90s nostalgia. But that's besides the point. I really think that this is just like so distracting and self-serving to just throw all this crap in there. And it just boggles my mind that you waste such a great technology and such obvious visual panache on something so idiotic.
Yeah, I mean, I only watched the trailer once, so I wouldn't say I have, like, complete knowledge of exactly what I don't know if I could retain everything that happened in the trailer. But for me personally, my initial reaction was that I was just surprised that this was coming from Spielberg, especially because, you know, recent films, he hasn't really done a lot of, I mean, I don't know if this qualifies, I guess it's more of an action sci-fi sort of type thing or whatever. I haven't read the book this film is based on either or whatever, but I was surprised by the trailer. It was just looked to me personally like tons of CGI being thrown on the screen. And, you know, we're going to be talking about that a little bit in our review of Valerian in a little bit. But that's like the trailer just sort of took me aback by that. And I also, I'm not sure how good an idea it is to just mash, you know, all these different characters. Oh, look, we got the Iron Giant and Freddy Krueger and Back to the Future DeLorean. What the hell is going on here? And, like, I haven't read the book, so I don't have a basis for this. I feel like I'm vaguely enough familiar with the story just because people have been talking about it or whatever. And I'm glad that an actor like Ty Sheridan is getting a lead role. I feel good for him because he's a good actor or whatever. But I don't know, for me personally, a lot of Spielberg's recent output has left a lot to be desired. And I feel like, you know, the way I used to be excited going to theater for a Spielberg film, nowadays I don't really have that. It's more like I'm hoping it's good, but most of the time it ends up being a bit too dull for my personal taste. So I guess we'll see what comes of Ready Player One. We can also just briefly touch on the trailers for DC's Justice League and then Marvel's Thor Ragnarok, because I think they serve as a nice point counterpoint. Ryan, your initial thoughts on either of these trailers?
We'll start with Justice League, just because I haven't been, and obviously, you know, I've made it known in this podcast before that I have only, the only film in this series that I've seen so far is Wonder Woman. I really don't care to see the other films. I know Andrew has been chastising me left and right for not giving it the effort and at least seeing how bad it is for myself instead of talking out of my ass. I don't care. I don't need to see it to know how bad it is. These trailers have done absolutely nothing for me. You know, the last one with the White Stripes song and the cheesy one-liner, it really feels like they're trying to play like Marvel light in that. With this, I think they're really, they got a much better grasp on their own tone, at least. It doesn't necessarily mean that what they were putting out was good. I still think, you know, that those shitty one-liners and this like really garish action that's on screen, it just absolutely does nothing for me. I still think, and I know you've at least sung Ben Affleck's praises for being a real sport about the whole thing and being probably the best thing about Batman versus Superman. But he still, to me, always looked a little bit uncomfortable, which is totally fine. I know that's, you know, there's an inherent amount of camp to the character, regardless if it's Christian Bale or Adam West. This is serving no purpose for me as a human being or as a film goer, and I'm just really not looking forward to seeing this one.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about Justice League is the first trailer they released, I was actually kind of, you know, I was actually kind of surprised at how it was just like, oh, it's a regular trailer. It didn't seem like they were trying too hard yet for the cheesy one-liners, but then these past couple of trailers, and more specifically this Comic-Con trailer, they're definitely trying to, you can definitely see, I mean, they're so worried. I mean, especially after the failure of Batman vs. Superman and Suicide Squad, they're so worried, you know, that they're not gonna have a franchise to try and compete with Marvel and get all, you know, the cash that these producers of the heads of the studios clearly want and to desperately see it. And obviously, if those of you who haven't heard, Justice League is currently amid $25 million reshoots under the helm of Joss Whedon, who obviously we know from directing the first two Marvel Avengers films. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see what the future of the DC Films universe is, because there's been recent reports that Joss Whedon is taking a bigger role and they're trying to phase out Zack Snyder. Gee, I wonder why. I know you mentioned, you talked a little bit about how not having seen, you know, you don't have to watch Suicide Squad, but you have to see Batman vs. Superman. You have to experience this. You have to see, see the direction it takes. And then when it gets to the Martha scene, you know, I mean, there's nothing that can possibly replace the first time seeing that film and just laughing hysterically at how terrible this movie is or whatever. But, you know, I didn't really comment much on the Justice League trailer because, you know, I'm neither here nor there. You know, I'm sure Joss Whedon could do a good job and possibly save it, but they're trying so hard to capture that Marvel tone. It's just sort of eye-rolling at this point. And then, as I mentioned, we have the Thor Ragnarok trailer, which I think both of us are definitely excited for because it comes from a filmmaker, Taika Waititi, who, if any of you haven't seen Hunt for the Wilder People, or I'm blanking.
What We Do in the Shadows.
Great. I mean, he's a really great comedic filmmaker, but he also has a real good heart. And I highly recommend checking out his previous work because it's really good. And Thor Ragnarok definitely looks like a lot of fun. He actually gave a recent interview. I don't even know if it was earlier today or in recent days, that Thor Ragnarok might end up being the shortest Marvel film ever, which is interesting. But I mean, the trailer is just a lot of fun. I'm looking forward. Always look forward to seeing Tom Hiddleston's Loki, which I think is definitely one of the lone highlights of the previous Thor films or whatever. But I'm hopeful. I think a lot of people are hopeful that this is going to be the best Thor film to date. And I think the trailer definitely proves it out with the new additions in Jeff Goldblum and Kate Blanchett.
Yes, and the return of Mark Ruffalo, of course, as the Incredible Hulk. Yeah, I'm really excited. Taika Waititi is one of my favorite filmmakers. I actually got, when Eagle vs. Shark came out, I got to go to a pre-screening of that, which was really cool. But yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. The Thor movies have always kind of been like mid-level Marvel for me. They're pretty fun, but I always like the Thor fish out of water stuff a lot more. I think that's where the best humor is mined from. So obviously him being on Planet Hulk is really just going to kind of lend itself naturally to that. Obviously it's a different setting than Planet Earth, but I still think it's going to be really funny. And obviously, you know, with what YTT has done in the past, this is just going to be a great movie. I actually feel like the trailer might actually betray what this film is actually going to be like. I think it's going to be a lot lighter hearted than the typical Marvel entry. And lately they've just been getting, you know, so depressing, but that's actually kind of why I appreciated Spider-Man as well. It's more in the vein of comic books just being fun, and this movie is going to be fun, and hopefully it's really funny too. And that's really where I stand on it.
All right, so now that we've discussed the brief movie news, we're going to turn our attention to Valerian. And as far as my opening comments on this film, I feel like Valerian is what happens when Luc Besson tries to does his impression of George Lucas in the prequel era of Star Wars. And I'm sure you can surmise that is not a compliment coming from me. Valerian, I mean, the film just never really works. It's like, it feels like, you know, I touched briefly on, you know, throwing CGI at the screen in that Ready Player One trailer. That's basically what this film is. It's almost too much. It's almost overwhelming at a point. And don't get me wrong, there are some, you know, cool, breathtaking visuals or whatever, but for the most part, it's just too much. And I think there's such a thing as CGI overload where everything feels so artificial that it feels hard to buy into anything. And I feel like that's really what Valerian suffers from at its core, other than, you know, being frustratingly paper thin. Ryan, your thoughts on Valerian?
So before I get back to the, you know, prequels analogy, I just want to say that obviously I had just because of Harry Styles' stature in pop culture, it just kind of stuck out to me in Dunkirk. That's probably more a knock on me than anything. But that was absolutely nothing compared to what the fuck they do in this movie with Rihanna and Herbie Hancock. I didn't even know Herbie Hancock fucking did movies, but he shows up here as the Minister of Space or some shit that I can't figure out. So obviously there are a couple other cameos. John Goodman plays some fucking alien thing, and Ethan Hawke is in it. Honestly, Ethan Hawke is the only good thing I'll say about this film. Ethan Hawke is actually really funny for like the 5 minutes that he's on camera, and it needed more of that touch. It needed more of that, you know, Luc Besson insanity instead of this CGI mad dash, which, and don't get me wrong, obviously, this is actually a collaboration between ILM and Weta, the two big, you know, powerhouses in visual effects, and it shows. Everything is really nicely rendered, and these are very creative and thoughtful and inventive scenery, but going back to the analogy of the prequels, every moment of this film feels like the hairbrush scene from episode 2, and Dane DeHaan is just such a fucking charisma vacuum. Cara Delevingne was terrible in this. There's this hokey old-timey, you know, like, oh, ain't no dame gonna show me up in the action scenes, and then, oh, then the dame shows her up, and it's just like this really chintzy winking at the camera bullshit, and none of it serves any purpose, and I can't follow the fucking story. I can't even tell you what that movie's about. I sat there for all 2.5 hours. I don't know what I watched. It's something about like some ancient alien race that infects Dane DeHaan's brain after their major genocide, and then they have to figure out what happened to this planet.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I don't put much of the blame at the actor's feet at all, much like I don't put the blame at the actor's feet in the prequels, because I feel like Luc Besson, the director, clearly needed to fire Luc Besson, the writer. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying his direction is amazing or anything, but at least it's, you know, you see the characters on screen, you know, there's at least some visual inventiveness, I guess, but the writing in this film is just so bad. I don't know how any actor could get, like, the cheesy one-liners that he makes Dane DeHaan. There's this running thing with, like, oh, like, Dane DeHaan wants to marry Cara Delevingne's character, Valerian wants to marry who, whatever the hell her character's name is, whatever, Lorelai or something like that, or whatever, and, like, he wants to take her to this nice beach, and that's, like, that's the purpose of their relationship. It's just, like, and then there's, like, cheesy one-liners, Dane DeHaan, like, cracking his neck after getting in trouble. He's, like, should have been at the beach. I don't even remember the line because it was so memorable. But the writing is just like the crazy thing about this movie is they expect you to follow these characters along in this journey, and you literally don't have any clue exactly what is even happening until they reveal the entire plot. Like, I think it's not even until the third act or something, if you can even make out act 1, 2, and 3 in this film or whatever. It just feels like a big CGI mess thrown at the screen. But I'll be honest, like, I definitely did expect more from Luc Besson in this film, because I feel like, you know, I think we talked about this briefly after seeing the film, you know, how typically there's typically a bit more to chew on in a Luc Besson film, but nowadays I guess he's just like, all right, let's create an experience. And also, I just wanted to mention that this is adapted from a comic or whatever that I've certainly never heard of, so I don't know if all this CGI and all these different races of characters, maybe he was taking too much from the comics and trying to put too much onto the screen, but regardless, it just doesn't really work as a film. And I did also want to give a shout out to Ethan Hawke, because, you know, I feel like in most Luc Besson movies, like, there's going to be, like, one name actor who's, like, in the cast, and you don't see them for a while, and then they're just going to show up as this, like, crazy out there character, and that is exactly what Ethan Hawke does, and it's delightful.
It really is, and I think, you know, getting back to that whole shtick, he's, like, the MC at some kind of a burlesque show or brothel, and Rihanna is this amorphous blob that's, you know, bright blue but can take the shape of anyone that she wants, and so that's used as a plot device, and it's still, they try to give her some nice little character arc with her being a real artist and being able to whatever the fuck she does, and it feels hollow and flat. There's no emotional beat, and, you know, and Dane DeHaan, all the dialogue in this is just so fucking bad. It's it's all like screenwriting 101 bullshit. Like, there's one, and everything is so derivative of either past Luc Besson work or any other sci-fi franchise. You know, when he's Dane DeHaan's character is walking down the alley leading up to this brothel, he sees all these prostitutes that are coming onto him, and there's one that's kind of like half, I don't know if it was like half peacock, half person or something, and he looks at it and he goes, sorry, I'm allergic to feathers. and he delivers it in like this most, if someone was trying to do a bad impression of Keanu Reeves, that's almost what the performance comes across as. So yeah, I know he was probably not given any direction whatsoever, and I know he's been better in better films. And even in The Amazing Spider-Man 2, I think he was slightly better in that film than he is here. But at the end of the day, there's literally just nothing going on in this. Yeah. It all looks good. It all sounds good. It's all shit, though. It is just pure shit.
Yeah, there's literally no reason to care about anything that happens. I mean, as I alluded to, you literally don't know what is going on. I also just want to mention that Clive Owen is in this film or whatever.
Oh, God.
And a sort of very thankless sort of role for him. You know, an actor who, you know, used to be in a lot of big movies and now his career has just fallen to this point or whatever, which I think is sad because he definitely has ability as an actor, but it's just a shame that he's wasted among this CGI mess.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually, Closer was on, it was either Stars or Cinemax the other night, so I rewatched the scene in the middle of the film where he was just like going all out with Julia Roberts and they're just like screaming at each other. But it's the way he plays that, he brought such like this brooding intensity and intimidation to the screen in the past. And I just don't know where the hell any of that goes. I think it was, you know, smart casting him in this role as the whatever general, whatever the fuck, but it's a waste. And you could tell he doesn't really want to be there. And I just feel bad for the guy because I know what he's capable of. And I'm sorry the Nick got canceled because I heard that was actually pretty good. I never watched it myself, but the guy deserves better work.
Definitely, definitely. And I think that pretty much wraps up. I don't think we want to spend too much more time talking about Valerian because it's just an incredibly CGI mass paper thin film.
Yeah, I'm good.
But next week we'll be back with our thoughts on Atomic Blonde and David Lowery's A Ghost Story.
A Ghost Story is probably my most anticipated film going into the summer. But until then, take care.